Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 70th episode of the Mod State Podcast. We appreciate you tuning in, as always. So if you want more of Mod State, go to modstate.com, find all of our op-ed and opinion pieces, all of the links to our podcast, and links to our social media outlets, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can find me at modstate_Nate, that's my Twitter handle. You can find me at Nate Welline, that's my Facebook. I've got all the links to the podcast as well. You know, 2018 is creeping up here, folks. We can put away the woes of 2017 or the successes of 2017, whatever way you look at it, and we can look forward and figure out and make some predictions about what's going to happen. But either way, I don't think it will be much less contentious than it has been in 2017. But let's talk about it with John.
You want the envelope? There. You take it. It's all yours. You kill all three of them for nothing. You greenhorn, you blockheaded jackass, you nincompoop.
All right, dude. Welcome back. You know, this is our 70th episode.
7-0, and here we keep threatening to have Tommy Lahren and Richard Simmons host this, but
well,
has materialized.
It has not materialized, but we're only at 70, so I feel like we're doing okay.
I'm thinking at some point they're gonna sweat into the oldies and whatever it is that Tommy Lahren's known for. It could only make this worse, and by worse, I mean more interesting.
It could only get more interesting. That's what you mean.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, the shorthand that, I mean, go on. Tommy Lahren, Richard Simmons, opening the Mod State Podcast.
I think that
maybe
would
we say more.
Yeah, I think that would be our intro, and it would just be a really long intro for as long as it took. And
as long as Richard Simmons would tolerate it.
Yeah, I don't know. Who gives out first?
Well, she's not going to want to go on, period. Okay. White Power Barbie, Richard Simmons. But he's a pretty gregarious soul, so I see him going on and having a decent time, and then at some point he realizes he's alone in the booth. You know?
Yeah, a tracking. I see what you're throwing down. We're gonna make this. Mm-hmm. We're gonna make this come to fruition because we keep talking about it, and
she's gonna sue us.
That's what I do, man. That's more publicity for Mod State.
You know, that's what's sad about the whole joke is just how right she will readily make us, because you know Richard Simmons would find it funny, would laugh it off, and at the utmost would send a cease and desist letter, like, don't do this again. We're like, well, we were planning to begin with. No. That's not going to be good enough for Tommy Lahren and company. You know this.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that that's how it would play out, but I don't know. I'm doing
Can you see the guy from sweating to the oldies really getting angry about this?
No, I think you get to that point where you're just not angry about. I really think it would take a lot to really do anything to sort of piss you off if you've done that much in your life. I don't know if that makes sense.
I mean, he works out a lot, so his stress level's probably bare minimum. His pulse probably never rises above 75, 80. Whereas Tommy Lahren, she might try to go postal on us. I don't know. But I see her getting more put out with this than him.
Well,
if you're wrong, maybe she'll send us a very sweet thank you letter.
Maybe. I don't know. We're going to get it. We're going to get it figured out. We're going to get it on here. It's going to be our intro, and it's going to be our highlight podcast episode.
One of these years.
So, man, how you been? Everything good? We're rolling into the weekend here.
Well, I mean, the Saints took care of business on Sunday, so it's two Christmas Eve. It's two nail biters series this year.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, I wasn't there for the first game back in the Dome, which was a game against the Falcons, you know, first game back after Katrina. I was babysitting my brother's kids for the NFC Championship game against Brett Favre and the Vikings before we went to the Super Bowl. And those were on record the two loudest games in the Dome, but there were several times on the screen they showed the decibels hitting 117 plus in the Dome. It was loud.
Yeah, I've never been around something quite that loud, but I think it was the Seattle that set the records back when they were actually keeping track in records of decibel levels.
Well, they showed one of the most brutal. It's the most brutal I've ever seen. I'm not going to say one of the most brutal because I haven't been to every game for the years. I'm interested to see how this. I don't know where this video came from, but you know, you've been to pro games before and they show different infomercials and whatnot. It was a TV commercial, so it was, you know, a TV enforced timeout on the field. And they showed on the new 4K HD Jumbotrons at each end zone, which looked great, by the way. But it was brutal, man. I mean, even I was cringing going, oh, and it was New Orleans versus Atlanta. And no, this didn't start with the Saints versus the Falcons. The first thing they did was culture. And then they showed the Real Housewives of Atlanta, right? Just this, a picture.
This is during a...
Then they... Oh, yes, during a pro game. Oh, I'm telling you, this was cold. Revenge is a dish best served, thus. Hmm. So they showed the Real Housewives of Atlanta under culture. Then they started just showing, just rattling off artists from New Orleans, you know, Louis Armstrong. Then who was the clown? Graham Parsons, who was Keith Richards' longtime aide. There was Truman Capote, who wrote Streetcar Named Desire and Breakfast at Tiffany's.
So I see what they're doing.
Right. So they did all this. Then they started talking about different accomplishments the two cities, you know, beyond culture, as far as names that attracted. And then finally they said, in clutch mode, I mean, this was a long commercial. I need to post it to Monday just so people can see what I'm talking about. You really have to be from the two cities, I guess, to get the full grip of this.
Yeah, to really understand.
But then, in clutch moments, they showed the scoreboard at the beginning of the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl for Atlanta, 28-3.
Whoa.
And then the final scoreboard. And then they showed the beginning of the second half against Peyton Manning and the Colts in 09, the Saints doing an onside kick, which I must admit, partisan bias aside, that's one of the ballsiest calls in sports history.
Yeah.
You know, but still, it was, I mean, even if you're not from New Orleans or Atlanta, like the cultural thing, just Real Housewives of Atlanta, Louis Armstrong, Fats Domino, Graham Parsons, just all these different names, you know, Tennessee Williams, and then just, I mean, just on down the line. It was the most brutal skewering I've ever seen at a pro game. I'm going, damn, I don't hate Atlanta that much.
Well, that's you got to think, football. That's someone's job to get ruthless like that. And
no, bro, when I send you this, you're going to go, they played this at an NFL game? Like, my dad and I were talking about it afterwards. Like, man, somebody really hated Atlanta.
Well, you send it to me. I'm going to watch it for sure.
I will, but I mean, I warn you.
Okay.
Whatever, you talk about what you want to talk about, Nate. It's all about you, know you what? And what you need.
I know. So here's the problem. I'm still trying to articulate my thought process on how I want to go about this in the first place. But it's this weird, like, lull week between the sort of waning, gasping breaths of 2017 into 2018. not a whole lot going on in Capitol Hill. Everyone's on vacation. Trump's golfing.
You make this seem like a filler track.
It's not a filler track. I'm not making it a filler track. What I'm saying is I'm trying to explore topics that we've already discussed, but making it more geopolitically relevant because I feel like I haven't done that recently. So when I talk about the tax bill, I plan to somehow talk about immigration, population age, demographics, economic theory. So if this doesn't suit you, not you, the proverbial you, then you can just hit stop right now. But this is far from a filler. Far from a filler. I'm trying to channel my inner George Friedman here. And
yeah. Well, then the best way to do that is to get into the CBA, the cost-benefit analysis. You wanted to talk about the tax bill, and is this going to come out in the wash, so to speak?
Yeah.
You wanted to compare whether or not, I mean, because the GOP has already said they're going to, at the very least, attack infrastructure in the spring. And as I said, precast, they're going to dare the Democrats to oppose them. I'm predicting right now, I'll say it again, immigration, if it comes up, it's going to be an afterthought, DACA type thing. Not that that's an afterthought to the people on the receiving end of that program, but as far as the political agenda goes. But infrastructure, obviously, but leading into that, talk about, you know, going to the tax bill, and honestly, do you think it's going to come out of the wash? Do you think the CBA, in the grand sum total of things before the election, doesn't matter if it happens in 2019 as pertains to the 2018 midterms? Right.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you on that sort of theory. Obviously, we're not going to feel an effect from this until, at least for the average, as we'd like to say on here, the average American. But
well, you're not going to file in spring of 2018.
Exactly.
Based on something that's not going to matter until spring of 2019.
Exactly.
Right? My state, Divinity Well Unlimited, when we file in March, it is not going to file based on this new legislation.
Exactly.
We're not.
So, again, like we've sort of predicted that I think you'll see effects at the business level before, and you'll see that in like quarterly. I mean, after the bill is actually put into law, which will take a number of months, but I think you'll start to see profits go up in quarterly reports, and that's something we can sort of flesh out over the next year. But I think we talked about infrastructure, and I think maybe we can talk about that for a little bit, because we did discuss that in, I think, the last couple podcasts about what is the safe softball approach to legislation in the midterm elections. And it's really important. Again, there's a lot of predictions being made, especially at high profile magazines. Places like The Economist are really predicting that it's going to be hard for Democrats to actually rally and take back a majority in 2018. I tend to agree, and the reasons I agree with that are for some issues that keep coming up in the courts. And that first one would be gerrymandering districts. And that's creating districts that again, aren't created by third party individuals. So these districts, for those people who don't really understand what gerrymandering is, it's a process in which you carve out your district. And you can do that. And by carving out your district, you actually create a constituency that will align with you politically, right? So in certain districts, they're aligned and so puzzle pieced out that a Republican will overwhelmingly always live there because or will always vote Republican there. The Republican will always win in that district. And they do that by census and by survey, and they find out door to door who's going to most likely vote more conservative versus Republican. And they just sort of etch out these districts, and that's a point of contention in the courts right now. And I think my perspective, and maybe you may agree with me, that I feel like that really needs to be left to an independent, third-party, non-biased entity, and to really have.
I agree, but you have to look at how this came about. And my personal theory on this, and full disclosure here, I'm kind of tipping the hat here to Politico, who has talked about this a lot lately. I haven't personally touched on it, editorially speaking, so I'm giving that nod to them that they have. But this comes about because the Democratic Party has not given due diligence to the state houses, meaning the state legislatures. They've let that go by the wayside, and they let 30-plus governorships, they almost just ceded it to the Republicans. And when that happens, I'm not saying this is right, I'm not justifying it, okay? But when you do that, when you place everything in the Team Obama and then Team Hillary camp, well, guess what happens when the Republicans control all the state houses? It means they are the ones in charge of drawing up the state maps.
Which is very true. Which is very true.
Which is completely legal, by the way.
It is.
Gerrymandering is illegal.
It is.
What they've done is they have voted people into power who are the ones that have the purview of dictating what the state maps are. I'm not saying it's right. And I agree with you that it ought to be a third party. Not going to happen. Okay, because both parties want that power when they're in power. So the Democrats, they help draw the rules of this game, and they're losing at it.
I think that's it's an interesting point you bring up. I'm reading a book right now called, I'll put it in the show notes because I'm going to butcher the author's name. Of course, I have a computer right in front of me and I could look it up, but it's called Listen Here, Liberal. And it's really sort of marching out the failings of the Democratic Party up into the loss of Hillary Clinton in 2016. And there are just certain aspects of that, the party, that they just lost their principle and they lost their roots. And, you know, you can't put all your eggs as an investment, as a man of economic studies. I mean, the number one thing you cannot do is put all your eggs in one basket. And when you do that and you have a failure like you do in 2016, the failure is so much more monumental and so much more disastrous than if you...
Two things, just real quick. Number one, I'm not arguing as to the morality, whether they're right or wrong. I'm arguing this just as I did that Trump would win the Rust Belt, not saying he should have or shouldn't have, right? As far as the Democrats go, and that's where number two feeds in here. This goes way beyond 2016, and I mean backwards. They put everything on winning the presidency in 2008, and yeah, in 2012, they were scared. Without Hurricane Sandy, I don't know that Barack Obama wins re-election, okay? So they put everything under the federal level. Well, now you have what you're reaping at the House level. So
yeah.
Not so fast when it comes to the Dems retaking the House. Sorry, but continue there. I just want to posit that. I'm commenting on a this is right or wrong level.
Okay, and that's fair. I think the other thing on top of gerrymandering, which, you know, if I understand you correctly, and I agree with you, when you lose sight of trying to gain victory at a state level, then if your opponent wins, your opponent dictates things like districts and the power in that state. The other thing is the concentration of progressives, liberals, Democrats in urban areas versus the non-urban area, the rural area, the suburbs. You know, these things also have to be taken into account when it comes to a Democratic victory in 2018. And I think it becomes more of the responsibility of the Democratic voter, and I don't mean the democracy Democratic voter, the Democratic Party voter, and the strategists and the campaigns to get out and really make a grassroots movement effort to get people eligible to vote, registered to vote, and to tell them where to go, when to go. And that's what you saw in Alabama. I mean, that is why Doug Jones won. Because
which House of Congress was that for?
Well, you're talking the federal level.
And, right. Which House of Congress? There's two houses.
Oh, you mean the Senate?
Right.
Yes.
Which is, there's two people from that state going regardless.
Exactly.
You're getting the House, you're getting into individual districts, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of, I hate, I'd love to see it, if nothing else, so that it would spur the Republican leadership to take this seriously and actually, I don't know, stick to what they campaigned on. But if you're asking me if right now that a Democratic candidate is going to come into the first district of Louisiana, Jefferson Parish, Metairie, Louisiana, and challenge Steve Scalise, or if they're going to come into, and that's a purple district, technically speaking, if they're going to go into Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and challenge Stephen Palazzo, a Marine Reserve officer, based on the fact that there's some anti-Trump, well, a lot of anti-Trump sentiment out there, they are sadly, sadly mistaken if they think that's going to be enough. It's not. I'm not saying it's not possible. But right now, there's a whole lot of, oh, you see, well, that means we're going to retake the House. Let's check our expectations and, hey, have lofty goals. All right, I'm an idealist myself, but you better damn well have some pragmatic means before you go, oh, I don't know, blow another $1 billion like you did with Hillary.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think
they're not going to waltz to beating men like Steve Scalise.
No, and I think the foundation had to be set for this far in advance, and I think everyone was shocked, obviously, in 2016, but I think you're playing catch-up right now. I really do. I really think the foundation, if you're truly looking to retake the House, I mean, that foundation needed to be set a while back, and if you're not focused at the state level in the first place, you're starting from scratch. And it's going to take to have the effort that you had in Alabama, which again, this is for one seat in Alabama, to do that. One Senate seat. To do that nationally in all the districts, first off, the financial burden that would take and the expense, really, that would take would just be outrageous. I think. Unless there's some sort of act, this miracle that the left is so riled up that people get out and for whatever reason, conservatives stay home. I don't see it happening. And
I'm not seeing it on a couple of levels right now. Number one, we know that Trump's base is not abandoning him.
No,
he's not dipped below that 33% mark. Okay, it might have been 32% at one point in a couple of polls. The fact is, that electorate is not abandoning him no matter what. Second thing is, remember before Alabama and Virginia and New Jersey, I believe, the prior two races.
Yeah.
I think they were both House, maybe I'm mistaken, but either way, those are the three states, okay? Before those three races, yes, all three of which went Democratic, remember, there were four races that all, including the heartbreakingly close race in the Atlanta suburban area, where John Ossoff was sought. He was thought to be this bell cow case, this watershed moment of Democratic uprising against Trump, and he lost. Okay, and he was this bright, some compared him to Emmanuel Macron. All right, so there's a 4-3 split here. In the first seven races. I'm not saying this, obviously, as someone who's getting paid out of the way, but if I'm a Democratic strategist here, and if they want to call me, I mean, they raised a lot more money than the Republicans did in 2016, and they still lost categorically across the board. This is not the time to get jubilant. This is the time to say, hey, we need to get our hands dirty in the trenches like we didn't in 08, 2012, 2016. Not saying they can't do it, but right now,
yeah,
I'm not seeing it. They think that the base is going to abandon Trump. Do you think it is?
No. I mean, they're for what? For what option? For the Democrat that comes in? Absolutely not. Unless there's some sort of Steve Bannon weird candidate that we don't know of yet. But again,
there's one name.
Which one's that?
Come on now.
What, Steve Bannon?
No, he's not a Democrat.
Oh,
There's one name on the left side of the aisle.
Oh, that's
a centrist.
Oh, that could pull this off. That could pull this off. Well, let me think of a few off the top of my head. One
would be a unifying factor. A. That's a blue collar type guy.
Ooh, this is a fun trivia.
he's associated with, I've said it at least, I'd say at least twice, maybe three times in the podcast. He's relatable, okay, on an everyday level, all right? He's got a great story, familial, in terms of family. And he's got the history, he's got the names.
Okay, so we're either talking about like Rubio or
we're talking about Joe Biden.
Okay, that was the second one. This sounds like you're talking about Joe Biden. I do believe that Joe Biden could do it, and I think that there is some Democratic remorse that wishes that he had actually run, but at the time he was not in the right frame to do it. I think he could have carried the Obama era momentum. I think it'll be interesting.
It's a tough spot to be in. His son on his deathbed asking him to run.
Yeah.
But I mean, come on, would you or I either one be in the state?
So, and that's just the thing. I mean, his son, obviously, I don't know if he had passed away at that time or had just, but, or was about
to. He just died.
He had just died. Look, I'd like to see Joe Biden go for it. I think there is. Let me throw something out here, and this may be unpopular, but I'm just bear with me on this. There may be some issues with Joe Biden. Now, precedent has been set by the President of the United States. I am not claiming there is no charges, there's no allegations, but there has been certain things that the President has said on Access Hollywood. And women that have come forward that have talked about sexual assault and sexual harassment, it obviously is not affecting his presidency. He is still the president of the United States, and there really is little that anything is being done about it. Joe Biden has in the past had some not charges, not or even real allegations, but has been known to be a bit of a womanizer, if you will, and maybe. A little, what's the word I'm looking for? A little creepy at times. And I've heard these personal.
You're talking about the thing with the Secretary of Defense's wife.
It might have been. There's been a few things. In even my personal experience being around him and the girls or the female officers at Walter Reed just getting a weird read and having some weird interactions. I am not saying that the progressives and the Democrats have some sort of moral high ground, but they do seem to eat their own when sexual harassment and sexual assault comes up, i.e. Conyers, Franken. Obviously, you didn't see.
So I guess the Kennedy brothers wouldn't make it now.
I don't think so. I'm being honest with you. Like in this climate really? Today.
Because of Marilyn Monroe.
Well, we're also talking about what's come out. I mean, I almost want to say it's a little bit apples and oranges. But
this is where I'm about to pull up, though. Really?
I don't know. I think at this point that progressives, Democrats, are just looking for someone that can be a champion, someone that can.
Someone who's spotless, who is without sin.
Look. Again, I am not accusing of anything, but this has been brought up before of why he may not be.
Who's going to beat Trump then?
They
better get real at some point, Nate.
They better
realize none of us are without sin.
Yes, there are some candidates out there that I think are just too. I think you need a powerhouse to come in, and I do think Joe Biden can do it. But I do hope that. As much as you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault, being creepy is something that we need to be very aware of and something that should be investigated. I hope that, you know, that again, if that's their man, you know, you're going to have to overlook that. And otherwise, you're looking at.
Is, I mean, nobody had their antenna raised when Bill Clinton was accused of using the Arkansas Highway Patrol as his escort service. I mean, at what point do you see here? I mean, that was glaring. All right. At what point here in the case of Joe Biden, and I know you're not saying he's been charged and or.
Oh, no. I mean, it may never come up if he does run. I don't know.
But at what point does it come? I mean, me, I'm Joe Biden, which I'm not. I've never been accused of anything, quite the opposite if you've listened to our podcast. But I'm going, just don't answer it.
Yeah. There's
no reason to engage. And if you're the Democrats, you better get real here and accept the fact that 33% of the country has showed they're not going to abandon Donald John Trump no matter what. Then there's the 15% that are going to vote Republican on top of that because they don't have a better alternative. The Democrats are the same way. You've got about 48% of the other side. So you maybe got a 3 to 4 point swing. And guess what? The incumbent's going to have the advantage. And if, God forbid, there's any kind of foreign policy crisis, that's going to swing in the incumbent's favor as well. All right, so you better get real here. You, the general, you on the Democratic side, if you want to beat Donald Trump.
Yeah,
they're not calling me.
And saying, I realize.
Hey, cut your check to be a strategist.
Yeah. I just think that with the momentum that we've seen in the last, well, the special election specifically, and in Virginia in some cases, depending on which way that swings, that there will be some sort of organic grassroots movement to get people out. Look, we've seen over in 2017 that we've had the women's marches, we've had these unity marches, we've had Charlottesville. Like, of course, we're going to take it back. Now is our time.
Good for them. And not going to swing a national election.
It's going to be very, very difficult. And I'm just
So this guy Castro, they love, who was the Housing and Urban Development Secretary under Obama, his last name is going to kill him.
Yeah, funny enough. Yeah.
So who's going to run? Elizabeth Warren?
I mean, she could. You know,
Bernie Sanders is going to be 90 years old, at least. I mean, not really, but I mean, come on.
Yeah. You know, we'll see. I mean, obviously, we've got 3 years left of this. And I mean, this, I mean,
they're making a mistake if they don't take him seriously, meaning Biden.
Well, yeah, that would be a mistake. I think that if there's anyone that stands a serious chance to take the presidency in 2020, it would be Joe Biden. But again, like, we have 3 years to develop characters and develop personalities and to develop platforms. And so who knows? I mean, maybe there will be.
There's one other, and it's much more of a long shot, but that's Mitch Landrieu.
Huh.
He was in position for a cabinet spot under Hillary Clinton had she won. Obviously, I sent you the link. I'm pretty sure you watched his speech, whether you agree with it or not. For our audience, it's irrelevant. If you watch his speech on YouTube, Mitch Landrieu, Mayor of New Orleans at the time, about why the monuments, the Confederate Memorial, should be removed from New Orleans. Again, it doesn't matter if you agree or not. It was passionate, it was charismatic, and it connected with people, whether they liked it or not. And he's, you know, he's a dark horse.
Yeah, he would. That would make to be the first mayor, right? That could take the presidency. What's that?
Well, to take the presidency,
yeah.
Actually win.
To win.
Can't say it'd be the first, but I would bet that it would be.
So anyway.
This time, it wouldn't matter. I mean, Donald Trump had no experience.
So yeah, I mean, that's for sure.
The arm could run against him. Not saying they could win, but
yeah,
it's not like the Republicans gave him a point of experience, but I mean, Mitch Landrieu, he did become president of the mayor's conference. Arguably the most powerful non-federal caucus in the country, and also helped secure the vote that, hey, we're going to go ahead with the climate accord being enacted in big cities in the country. He did that with Congress and the president saying we're going to rescind those rules. So, I mean, he positioned himself well. Now, I don't know if the Democrats are smart enough to nominate him, A, and B, if Landrieu was capable of organizing a national movement, because that's what it takes now. Unless you're Donald Trump, it takes $1 billion behind you.
Yeah, really not that much, to be honest.
So, there's that.
Yeah, there's that. There's some good 2018 perspective, 2020 predictions, if you will.
Then there's the Supreme Court.
Then there's the Supreme Court as well. Yeah, interesting, the Supreme Court. I think that again, I'm not a student of history, and most definitely not a student of history of the court. But we do have two justices who, we'll just say, are probably nearing the end of their term. And terms, if you will, and that would be Kennedy and Ginsburg. So I look at this now as a maybe one of the most opportunistic times of justices potentially leaving the Supreme Court. And really, the Republicans or conservatives have a potential to really shape the court for generations to come based on their control of the confirmation power within the Capitol. So a couple things could play out. Both Ginsburg and Kennedy could retire, or they could not retire. They could continue on. They could pass away, or one of them could. So there's a number of different things that could happen. But it is it's a unique funnel point, if you will, or where you've got age mixed with a perfect political climate to nominate a conservative judge. I don't know. Again, can't predict anyone's retirement or departure from the court for various reasons, but it is something to look at. I think if you're Democratic, if you're progressive, if you lean left, you're hoping and praying that they put Ginsburg in a, what do they call them? Like a bubble boy, right? and I guess for Kennedy's, if he leaves, they can nominate someone like-minded. But
yeah. Kennedy's a rare breed.
He's
a true centrist. He aligns himself conservatively majority of the time, but then, as in the case of gay marriage, for instance, decided that there was no constitutional precedent against allowing same-sex couples to get married. It was definitely not a conservative position, but he articulated, in my opinion, fairly well that he felt that he was right.
He's had some, and when you say centrist, I mean, he really has been the...
he's been the only one of the court.
Yeah, this kind of the swaying. I mean, when you look at Supreme Court cases,
people, you got four living, breathing document justices, and then you've got four original intent justices.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Kennedy,
who has been obviously an advocate or a champion of same-sex gender or same-sex marriage. And again, he's had some interesting the healthcare bill that went through, and he's had some interesting viewpoints on marijuana. So he's really this sort of swing vote that many people.
Stays, me personally.
What's that?
I hope he stays.
I hope so too, because I really do believe that
we may not have another centrist in our lifetimes.
Exactly, and that's
literally
exactly, and that's why I sort of lament his leaving or his potential leaving. Because again, like as a centrist myself, as a person that I enjoy being at that sort of or having that ability to examine both sides and make a rational decision based on the facts that make more sense, based on the examinations that make more sense. To me, that is a better position to be in than a either hard-lined by the paper, if you will, originalist federalist, or someone who believes it's living and breathing and is allowed to be amended where it needs to be amended. I think the centrist viewpoint can take up both of those arguments and pick the best one. I would hate to see someone like that go, and I wish that he had many more years on the in the court, but I don't know who you can find that would be as centrist, and certainly not in this political climate. Will you pick someone that centrist unless they evolve?
It's unfortunate, I think.
It is unfortunate. I think that it would, unless that individual's opinion evolved over time, I don't think you see someone placed in that position or nominated and confirmed into that position, especially with this administration now. Which is actually pretty funny and ironic, because again, if I had an interview with the president, I would ask him about his his sort of dramatic shift to conservatism when he'd been fairly progressive his entire life, but how he would feel nominating someone that would rewrite, effectively affect the court's decision for generations by replacing someone with a potential conservative background and replacing someone that was such a key player in the swing vote. I don't know. Be interesting to hear a response to that. But
I know there's the living, breathing philosophy on the left, and there's the original intent philosophy on the right. You know, I'm not a lawyer, and even if I was, I don't see me getting an appellateship, much less being entertained as being worthy of the United States Supreme Court. But what is so wrong with the Kennedy philosophy, Justice Kennedy philosophy, of looking at it as, okay, I understand what the founders said, what would they say if they were here today? And it sounds like the introduction to a really poorly framed, antiquated joke, but I don't see that's so wrong. I mean, for instance, George Washington argued against, in his farewell address, having a standing army. You know, yeah. Thomas Jefferson felt we didn't need a standing navy, and then D.C. got burned down.
Exactly.
Right after the turn of the 18th century. So I think those men might, the men and the women now, might have a different feeling in regards to original intent. I'm not saying it's living, breathing, but couldn't it perhaps evolve if they were here today? And yeah, there's some gray there. There's some uncertain territory there, but so it is with all things.
Yeah, it is very difficult for me to believe, again, no one went back, no one can go back in time and sit down with any of the founding fathers and ask them their original intent. But as you watch history evolve, we make decisions based on the times. And again, we're not rewriting the Constitution, but we make national security decisions. We make economic decisions based on the evolution of society at large, the society of the world. And again, I don't know what stifling of progression happens when you look at a document and you say, this is exactly how they wanted it to be forever. Again, how do you know that? I don't know that you know that. You don't know that definitively, regardless of what you read from these founding fathers. And again, we don't know how loosely interpreted they wanted these documents to be. But you can't...
Well, it's just that the other side of this comes in and that, you know, they made space in D.C. for president and the vice president's living quarters in what's called the Department of War. They didn't plan on D.C. becoming this 9 million plus metropolitan area. Okay, so the other side of that is maybe they intended for the government to never be involved in some of the areas that it's involved in now. We don't know. We'll never know.
No.
And in some ways, it's foolish to me to try and recreate that.
Exactly. When you look, you can only, you know, the human mind can only has a capacity for so much, right? And you, when you're framing something, a document that's going to dictate how this country operates and create the democracy for this new country, I think it becomes very difficult to think prospectively and even understand what is on the horizon. If you say 300 years from now, 250 years from now, we'll be on the moon. We will have this thing called the internet. We will be able to fly through the sky. We will, you know, when we talk about invasion of privacy and search and seizure, now we have cell phones and we have phones that we can communicate. I mean, it's so to be able to even predict that would be near impossible, but then to you really create a framework based on what you have. And they took the best information and the best philosophy available at that time and crafted a document that I have a hard time believing they meant it to be a fixed document. And this was the only way that it would be. You can interpret it exactly, like literally like the Bible. I don't believe
I think that's where the framers' intent viewpoint comes from, is that there were men from that time frame, and unfortunately they were all men. We didn't have another viewpoint, but these landowners at the time, there were some of them that felt like, hey, we don't need to get involved. I mean, it's like Nixon said in the end of his final book, Beyond Peace, he said, we understood our mistakes from trying to enact national health care, now known as Nixon care, you know, from realizing it wasn't feasible. And there's certain things that the government has tried to do very well for the people, but we realize these are areas in which the government never had any business being involved in to begin with. So there is the argument, there exists the argument from amongst the original intent folks that, hey, they wouldn't try and answer these questions now because they don't believe the central government. You can remember, these guys believed that state governments were superior to the federal government, okay? That government was there to organize in times of war and to organize infrastructure. That's where those folks are coming from. Now, I am not going to insult their intelligence. Many of them are far more educated than I am on paper, okay? But I do understand where they're coming from, and maybe that's their answer to this, saying the feds shouldn't be involved in this period.
Which is fine. I get that, hey, the federal government shouldn't be involved in certain things. I agree with that to a degree. But when, again, when you
have... Your answer is, where do you draw the line? And that's slippery slope.
I guess that's probably the you know, you're right. Again,
I'm not arguing that.
I know you're not. And I agree. Again, we've talked about this ad nauseum. There is a level of federal oversight that I think is warranted in certain situations. I don't want federal oversight over everything. I would like state control. But again, it comes down to what is right and what is happening. Where is progression being stifled, and where can the federal government step in and make a difference? In the case of same-sex marriage, that was not happening at a federal level. That there was nothing within... maybe over time there would have been something that was passed, but they made a decision on that because they had to, because no one else was. And I mean, in some cases, again, I think there were certain justices there that felt like the federal government had to stay out of this. And how do we possibly make a judicial ruling on something like this? But, you know, there's a really good book. I'm going to completely fail here, but I'll get it for the next podcast and I'll put it out there in the show notes. But there's a lot of talk about this judicial system having way too much oversight. And I think any branch of government that has too much power sort of just tips the balance a little bit too much, and that's not right for our democracy. But there is, you know, talk now where these federal courts are blocking things like Donald Trump's travel ban and making these decisions. And there's a lot of grumbling that they're overstepping their reach, that, you know, someone in Hawaii, as Jeff Sessions would say, someone on an island is making this decision, although that is sort of the Hawaii just happens to be the gateway of the Pacific to the United States, but whatever. You know, there is, it's interesting, and maybe it is something that we should explore more, and that is the power of the federal judicial system. And it's something we haven't really talked about, and I need to research more. But again,
it's been criticized as legislating from the bench. The judiciary is not there to legislate.
Exactly.
They're there to decide whether or not a law that has been passed, for instance, is constitutional.
Exactly.
Okay? And that's kind of where some of the framers' intent folks come from in saying that, hey, you know, a better example, or not a better example, but to me, same-sex marriage was a lot easier to say, okay, well, there's nothing in the Constitution that's forbidding this. This is an easy vote for. An easier example for what we're trying to get at is the original landmark decision in which Chief Justice John Roberts so infamously decided or sided with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. This was right after I had gotten transferred to D.C. in 2011, you know, summer 2011, and the dissent was written by Justice Scalia, and he said, I would like to look at the men and women in this room and say, the people in this country, is there one area of my life that the federal government is not allowed to dictate? What's next? I got to buy an iPhone because that's what's prescribed to me by the federal system? Now, you can say that's hyperbolic if you want to, okay, going from insurance to technology devices. But his point was, if this is allowed, what's next? They could require me to buy a product, or they fine me, which is what the Affordable Care Act carried with its individual mandate or what. And I think you made a great point there. That's, to me, an easier line of demarcation for our argument here of, well, I mean, what is the line?
Yeah.
Is there one anymore?
And I think what's interesting is I don't necessarily believe that his argument was inherently against healthcare for individuals, or I think that's what people lampooned him for, was because he wasn't for the progression of healthcare in this country. But
I guess the way it was framed.
Yeah, exactly. It was. It really just comes down to the power that the federal government has over the individual, and that would be essentially denigrating their right to liberty, their right to their property, which is money. And it's a good argument. And it's an argument that's used back and forth for many of these programs that are put forward, even taxes in general, or universal health care, or, I mean, you name it, we can go down the line, but it's that.
He was long denigrated for being, you know, anti-intellectual. And I'm going, I don't see anything anti-intellectual in that argument at all. I think it's really easy to cast that argument off as being anti-intellectual. That's intellectual laziness, in my opinion. No, if God forbid, the Ivy League left have to come out and actually argue on the merits of the Constitution, because I posit, and this is, again, I think we need to have another podcast on this, like we've talked about a number of times, but I suggest that a living, breathing viewpoint is actually very dangerous in the sense that, well, what happens if you get a bunch of Roy Moores from the court? What if you get beyond him a bunch of neo-fascists that, oh, yeah, they got a living, breathing viewpoint?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. That looks so good then.
Exactly. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's an argument to be made on both sides. And I think that's why when you lose that centrist on the court, you really lose that, dare I say, rationality. And I'm not saying that one side's irrational or both sides are irrational. I'm not, because they have their argument, and it's far more, it's way more articulated than mine. But I fear that the loss of that that swing, the vote, instead of just having two sides or a majority of one side pitted against the other, I think you need that wild card. And when you lose that wild card, you know, there's a lot of decisions that are made that, again, for better or for worse, we're predicting them. We're sort of making assumptions about what would happen, and I don't think that's the point here. But
names like Mark Pryor don't really give me any comfort.
No, not really. But, you know, it'll be something to explore. We haven't really talked about the judiciary that much, and that's part of my Mod State 2018 New Year's resolution is to become more researched in the judiciary, and you know, give you all some more info, some better. So I definitely did not, at the beginning of this podcast, I said I would be talking about tax reform and demographics and age and immigration. And you know what I successfully did after almost an hour of talking is not talk about any of that. So if you were totally not interested in that, then you won. And if you were...
I'm sorry,
I guess. We'll bring it up.
I'm sorry. I'm the one that, I guess, got us off on all manner of rabbits.
No. I would... I like the... It's a little bit of... this forward thinking of things that could happen in the years to come. And we can always
forward
talk about
tax
reform.
And the Constitution.
What about it?
Forward thinking and the Constitution. You don't hear those framed together very often.
You don't. You heard it here in Mod State, ladies and gentlemen. Forward thinking and the Constitution. But I do believe that maybe in the next couple podcasts, we'll get back into that. That's obviously a topic that we'll hit again, because the tax bill is obviously going to be enacted and we'll see the effects of that. So we can leave that for another podcast. But I did want to point out to you, and I don't know if I told you this or not, but
Me?
Yes, to you. The Economist came out with their most what's the term they used? The maybe it's the strongest country or the most improved country of the year. So I did want to tell you that it was between two countries, but your beloved France won out as the
motherland,
the strongest country of 2017.
Do you agree with that? I mean, you and I had talked about doing a nation of the year. I mean, I noticed they pointed out in years prior that it's not based on pure might, because otherwise it'd be tough to not vote for America, China, or Russia. But it was based on, you know, overall
so
improvement socially and economically. I mean, do you agree with it?
So there, when I really looked at it and was trying to think of a country that maybe made more gains, if you will, when it comes to progressive social structure, immigration, France really did come out strong. And of course, that was Emmanuel Macron that, if I said that right, and Macron.
You said it beautifully.
Thank you. He really stepped up when other countries were having some sort of political uprisings, political issues within their countries. Obviously, Great Britain had Brexit, and Germany's been split a little bit, even with immigration within their country. And France stepped up, especially with the Paris Climate Agreement, with Macron taking a leadership role there, him accepting more immigrants and refugees. I mean, they really came out strong at the end of the year, and especially with their leadership. I obviously, most people can think of him with Donald Trump during 2017, and Donald Trump sort of overshadowed this young former banker sort of overshadowed him, but the spotlight was on Donald Trump. But I think the sort of social progressive issues that most of the media likes that's why they picked him. And I guess, I mean, France is not without its social unrest and issues, but I think it wasn't overshadowed by some of the far, obviously Marine Le Pen, she was defeated there, but that was really sort of the last on a national scale that you really heard of that far right party. But you really heard about it in these other countries like Germany that would have been probably in contention for that. I don't remember who.
In Poland,
yeah, for that matter, right now.
Ironic. I mean, if Marine Le Pen had wanted France, for instance, we would be talking about Frexit.
Exactly.
And just how much hung in the balance there. I mean, France was, I like the way the Economist put it, it was seen before Macron as a country that was largely unreformable. It was either we're going to go with the old guard the way they think, or we're going to go the way of the ultra-nationalists. And somehow or another, this group has... I told you before, it used to be a joke, there's no such thing as a French moderate. Well,
Looks
like they're in power now.
Exactly. So the other country that was in contention there was South Korea. And I think the reason France and Macron won out was because of really the social progressive issues. I think South Korea, because of their sort of political unrest with their president over the last year, that put them into second place. But I mean, they've had to deal with a lot. They've had to carry the Asian Pacific leadership there and try to assert democracy there while having to deal with this insane rogue leader in North Korea. But I think between those two countries, I really do believe that France wins out there. So, you know, we'll have to make a concerted effort to have our top five or biggest movers for 2018 into 2019. We'll put that on the old calendar. I bought this huge, like a desk calendar that one might have to put on their desk, but I've got it on the wall, and I'll make sure that I write. Oof, I'm just throwing things all over here. I'll make sure that we put that perspective thinking there. We'll come up with our top five movers. So we're coming up on an hour. We've got the weekend beat coming up, and of course, the new year. You doing anything fun for the new year?
Probably not.
Awesome. Me either. Have some family over and, you know, try to make it to midnight. Go to sleep.
I don't do that enough for late, like, so.
You don't sleep anyway. So you'll be ushering in 2018, and
it's in the morning. What? Another year. I mean,
it's another year.
Exactly. I don't know that January 1st is going to bring in any tremendous aesthetic changes.
No.
You need to be aware of as the clock strikes.
But what it will do is usher in a Mod State podcast. So we'll be back on the first of the year. So all of your hungover ears and brains can take in intellectual, savvy dialogue. Maybe. Hopefully that's the plan. So
we'll dial back a couple of decibels for everybody's headaches.
Sounds good. I like that idea. So, well, my friend, with that,
au revoir.
We'll see you.